Unless he sponsored one of these, then you can do
so it. Then we can do another one. Then, if and listen, if if a Reformed Jew would sponsor it, we'd put Abraham Geiger up here. You know, whatever we need to do. Okay, first of all, poskim b'chvarach Sanya, I wanted to thank Rebbetzin Sarah Bienenfeld for opening her home to our shir, so we could all get together in Chanukah and learn together. The truth is, without giving too much introduction, I want to get right into this, because there's a lot to discuss when it comes to Rav Yosef Karo. But it's very, very appropriate that this entire Lifetimes in Torah series be beginning on Chanukah. The whole notion of Chanukah is basically serving as an iconoclast against the greater landscape of whatever the host culture and host society may otherwise put out there, and nowhere is that more understood and recognizable than I think in terms of celebrities, right? The people that any given society places on a pedestal and really puts up there as being sort of the paragon of whatever we consider to be excellence. So, of course, Greek culture had their heroes and their superstars, and modern day Western culture has their superstars and the people whose likenesses you see all over billboards and posters, etc., etc. And it's a very, very powerful statement, especially on Chanukah, to get together and say that this is who we put up on a pedestal. Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, is the sort of personality that we really believe to be our celebrity, our superstar, and nothing could be greater in terms of an appreciation, and we'll see, a full-blown appreciation of everything that he did and everything that he was, than to be able to also understand some of the backdrop and some of the background. So I wanted to do, and there are going to be some texts actually interwoven through this, but basically to give a brief biographical sketch, maybe a little bit longer than just a brief one, and then also to learn some of Rav Yosef Karo's Torah together. So, first and foremost, Rav Yosef Karo was born in 1488 in Spain. He's born in, I said this before, but he was born in Toledo, in basically central Spain. It's just south of Madrid. Madrid is sort of being blocked by that big red dot that I put up on the screen. But he's born in Toledo, Spain. I always say that all great Yosefs are born in Toledo. Worked out even better. That joke goes over even better in Toledo, Ohio. But this is where he's born, 1488. So as you can imagine, growing up in Spain in 1488, he's not going to last very long living in Spain. And his family, along with all the other Jews, are forced out in and around 1492 with the onset of the Inquisition. Inquisition's already been going on, but with the ultimate full-blown expulsion of all the Jews. The Inquisition basically is a failure, which is how the expulsion comes to happen. The whole nature of the Inquisition was to try to assess and to try to determine who was legitimate, who was genuine in their conversion and in their baptisms, etc., and who was not necessarily. And it doesn't go over well. The ability of the Jew to sort of say whatever may be necessary and required on the outside and externally, it doesn't necessarily impact who he is internally and what the truth may actually be beneath the surface. So the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492 leaves Rav Yosef Karo and his family, he's all of 4 years old at the time, they actually move west, further away from continental Europe and deeper into the Iberian Peninsula. They actually move to Portugal, and they're only there for a couple of years until 1497, when the Inquisition and the expulsion hits Portugal as well. Jews are not welcome in Spain, Jews are not welcome in Portugal. This has nothing to do with the Shi'ar, but believe it or not, many, many Jews, this is how Jews ultimately end up in South America, and the Inquisition follows them there as well. We sort of believe that the Inquisition sort of comes and goes with 1492. That is by no means the case, and it actually follows them into South America, into Brazil, and other areas also, and continues to be very, very, to spell disaster for the Jews. So the question is, where do Jews go following the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and from Portugal, 1497. So the new door that's opened, we always say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu never closes a door without opening a window. So following the Inquisition and expulsion of the Jews from Spain, one possibility, which becomes a very, very important possibility and very important opportunity for the Jews, is the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire actually opens its doors to the Jewish people, welcomes them. It's like lo yu'uman ki yasupar, to say it today, that once upon a time, the Jews were far better off living amongst Muslims than living amongst Christians. But this is very, very much the story of a significant portion of Jewish history. And it's the Ottomans, it's this Muslim empire that declares its doors open, its gates open to any Jews who have an interest in coming. And it's the Christians who had previously shut the door on the Jews. Things go a little bit topsy-turvy. It's the nature of the world we live in. It's an olam hafuchos, and everything is you know, upside down and switches back and forth over the course of history. But this is where we are, at least at the time. Now, where that ultimately leaves Rav Yosef Karo, this is a fascinating depiction. I didn't even realize this was a such an important piece of Ottoman history. But this was sort of the last great crusade against the Ottoman Empire's expansion. And this is the, I believe it was called the Battle of Nicopolis, which is today Nicopol, which is actually in the Ukraine. We don't usually think about the Ottoman Empire as expanding all the way there. We think about Ukraine as being very much like Ashkenazi, Ashkenazi Christian territory, I think. But this is basically where we are. How exactly the Kairos get there, I can't tell you. Perhaps a bona fide historian can. I don't know if it means having sailed through the Mediterranean, then worming their way through ultimately up north of the Black Sea. But here is where they ultimately find themselves. Nicopolis is a small city, a very, very important city. Again, this was like the last great stand of Christendom against the Ottomans. But the Ottomans ultimately take over, and the Ukraine becomes, actually, at least portions of the Ukraine become a very important area and section of the Ottoman Empire. This is where Rav Yosef Karo is. This is where he settles from Be'erech 1500 to 1520. So he's still a young man. He's still very much a young man. But despite the fact that he is a young man, this is the first encounter that we know of between Rav Yosef Karo and the Magid, the Magid Meisharim. The Magid is not something that that Rav Yosef Karo especially spoke of and was especially public about. One account actually has Rav Shlomo Alkabet sort of not exactly outing him, but speaking about the fact that that his Rebbe, or one of his Rebbeim, Rav Yosef Karo, was visited by a Magid. There are small little fragments that start to surface, and then posthumously, after his death, the Sefer of Magid Meisharim actually appears. The Sefer Magid Meisharim is really a diary of the encounters between Rav Yosef Karo and the Magid. So who is this Magid? The Magid is some sort of angelic being that Rav Yosef Karo has a chavrusa with over the span of about 50 years. He's visited at night by these visions at night, the same Malach continuing to visit him and continuing to study with him, continuing to overwhelmingly to give him Musar, to exhort him for things that he may not have been doing correctly, whatever it means for somebody to have had some sort of lacking even as he's being visited by a Malach. But the Magid sort of keeps him on the straight and narrow, teaches him some aspects of Kabbalah, and also continues to remind him of the importance of studying Kabbalah. Rav Yosef Karo was a great Mekubal, but on the one hand. On the other hand, you don't really get that sense from the writings that we are really familiar with, which, by the way, in of itself, and it's worth pointing out here, is a very, very important distinction that is made in the mind of Rav Yosef Karo. That is the distinction between halacha and Kabbalah. The great halachic works that Rav Yosef Karo actually authors are not at least ostensibly influenced by Kabbalah all that much, which is not the case necessarily of all halachic writings or of all Kabbalistic writings. And this is not the case before him, is not the case after him. We'll speak about that towards the end. Perhaps Rav Mordechai Yaffe, who wrote the Levush, the Levushim, was more favorable towards a Kabbalistic way of thinking, even when it came to matters of halacha. And in our own minds and in our own Jewish halachic kind of milieu, we tend to think about there being a distinction between the two. That whatever may be true al pi Kabbalah is not necessarily how we act al pi halacha, and not that never the twain shall meet, but generally speaking, we view them as being almost two parallel kinds of worlds. And we err on the side of Gemara and Halacha and Svara and logic, etc., etc. And despite the fact that Rav Yosef Karo clearly had one foot in each world, nevertheless, clearly, right, if he has these notes in his diary about having learned with his angelic being, nevertheless, when it comes to his Sifrei Halacha, the Sifrei Halacha are very much that. They're very much Sifrei Halacha, grounded and predicated upon Halacha the way that we would really understand it. One is really a function of the other, right? We so foundational, well, to a degree, it's sort of either a vicious cycle or, you know, it's like a chicken and the egg sort of thing, is it that we tend to view them separately because so foundational were the works of Rav Yosef Karo that this is now how we abide in terms of our Judaism? Or is it that his works specifically became so popularized because there was already this sort of like, I don't want to say schism, but this distinction in the popular Jewish consciousness that one should not necessarily impact the other to too great a degree. When you read a Beis Yosef and you read a Halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, you don't have any sense in the world that night that Rav Yosef Karo authored this Sif of the Shulchan Aruch, that night he was visited by a Malach and they were learning Kabbalah together. You have no idea whatsoever. Yeah, in the back.
I don't understand. What he refers to this Amagin in what?
He kept a diary where he speaks about this Magid coming to visit him. And there were others in his circle who also spoke about it. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz says that this Magid actually, the earliest sighting or the earliest interaction that Rav Yosef Karo wrote about already happened in Nicopoli. But that Rav Shlomo Alkabetz speaks about his having learned with the Magid even when he was in Salonika in Greece. Later on, Rav Yosef Karo did. But whatever it is, meaning this is even before he comes to Eretz Yisrael. It says at a very, very early, you're talking about a young man in his 20s already having this very otherworldly sort of divine kind of interaction.
And other people knew that he was having a divine meeting?
I don't know to what degree then, at the time, but
ultimately
yeah.
And his writings about the Magid are discussing Kabbalah?
Yeah, but they're notes. They're very terse. I mean, it's like very difficult. If you've ever appeared, I've peered into a Magid Meisharim, you know, a couple of times. My Magid told me to check it out. But it's very herky-jerky. I mean, aside from the fact that even if it wasn't herky-jerky, it was straightforward. I don't know that I'd be able to tell you what's happening.
Luckily, he brings out that.
But they're notes. They're notes.
Is that from the Magid?
I don't know that he says that it's from the Magid.
Absolutely. I don't know if it's from his Rebbe. He calls
from his Rebbe or from the Magid?
So they weren't the same?
No, he certainly had Rebbeim. For one thing, when he's in Nicopol, he starts to learn with his father. His father becomes at least his Rebbe in his formative years. We'll see. Once he gets to Tzfat, he also comes under, I don't want to use the expression, under the influence of others as well. Some other very prominent
Rebbeim.
Was a Malach. No, speaks about him as the Mishnah. It's sort of like the
personification. How old was he then?
He starts it a little bit later. He starts the Beis Yosef. Beis Yosef isn't published until 1550. Till 1550. He starts it about 15 years prior. It starts in about 1535, I think, something like that. Before its publication. Shulchan Aruch comes later. Beis Yosef is first. Beis Yosef comes first. Yeah, Shulchan Aruch comes later.
When did he learn this Kabbalah?
When did this happen? 50 years. This is an ongoing...
But it happened when he wrote the Beis Yosef.
Even beforehand.
He does bring down Kabbalah in the Beis Yosef much more than Shulchan Aruch.
Well, he brings down Halacha much more in the Beis Yosef also. I mean, Beis Yosef is a much more comprehensive look at Halacha Bichlal than is the Shulchan Aruch itself. We'll see. I want to point to a couple of notes from the Hagdamah to each that sort of starts to encapsulate what each one is actually supposed to be. But very, very interesting interactions that he has. Again, the actual notes or the actual diary doesn't actually really become public until after his death. From the Ukraine, he moves south and bounces around a little bit. I wasn't sure how easily these would be visible. But between 1520 Be'erech, circa 1520 to 1535, goes from Adrianople to Salonika to Constantinople, none of which is known by said name today. Adrianople is Edirne, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is in the westernmost portion of Turkey, right by the border with both Greece and Bulgaria. He then goes to Salonika, which we speak about a lot in terms of this period of time in Jewish thought, but is today Thessaloniki, also in Greece, and then bounces back to Turkey and goes to Constantinople, which we know today, of course, is Istanbul, but spends some time in this area prior to finally settling in Eretz Israel.
Was there a reason that he had to travel? Like, was it like the Jewish people?
It's unclear, at least to me. There may be more about it. But he spends until he actually settles in Tzfat a great deal of time traveling back and forth. On that note, and we'll see once he gets into Eretz Yisrael, this might become very, very significant. The Beis Yosef really, really experienced galus. I mean, really, right? He's actually thrown out of his home not once but twice. As much as the doors are then open to, you know, Muslim, you know, Ottoman Empire, can imagine that it wasn't necessarily wholly comfortable. And indeed, he bounces around quite a bit. It's in Salonika that actually begins the Beis Yosef. But to a degree, there is a sense that he may have sort of viewed this very, very much, this very intense level of galus, as being Chevle Mashiach. And if that's Chevle Mashiach, then the reality that he ultimately ends up in Eretz Yisrael, and we'll see, not only does he end up in Eretz Yisrael, but he's actually part of a scheme, for lack of a better term, to try to reinstate the former glory of Eretz Yisrael, maybe all part of this grand picture. Also, again, this sort of Kabbalistic kind of background, viewing the things in somewhat messianic terms, all of this may come to bear on what actually takes place once he gets to Tzfat and what his life looks like. It's here, it's in Salonika that he actually begins work on the Beis Yosef. And the Beis Yosef at the time did not look like this. This is much prettier. So what's important from this picture, first of all, is that this is very much how the Beis Yosef was authored, which is that it is a super commentary on the, really a commentary, not a super commentary, a commentary on the Tur, on the Arba Turim. The Arba Turim was written by Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, son of the Rush, son of Rabbeinu Asher. And the Beis Yosef actually writes, and this is what I wanted to take a look at. This is just a couple of very, very interesting tidbits, but don't spend enough time. You know, it's like sometimes we kind of wonder how things come about and what the purpose of any given Sefer is. Sometimes the author of said Sfarim actually does us the great service of telling us ahead of time exactly what he's planning on doing, exactly what it's all about,
what he's writing. Where did the author of the Tur live?
He was Ashkenazi.
How did he get it? Read the commentary on it. Like, there was not such a large printing.
Not printing, but things certainly traveled. Things certainly traveled. So much so that even in the life of, I mean, we'll see. In the life of the Beis Yosef, there was both opposition and also acceptance of what he was writing in Ashkenaz. The Ramah, well, to the Ramah at the very end, but the Ramah held Rav Yosef Karo in extremely high esteem, right? The Ramah was living in Krakow in Poland, and the Beis Yosef at that time was living in Tzfat. So, yeah, you'd think, like, how do they have any interaction with one another? There's far more interaction in the Jewish world than we, obviously, far, far less than exists today, not just because of the lack of social media, but just the lack of printing. You can't just print things as easily and send them and ship them, obviously. But there was more interaction than we assume. There was more interaction than these. Even in the writings of the Rishonim, there are instances of Sephardic Rishonim making mention of the Bali Tosfos, and every now and again you'll get a quote of the Bali Tosfos mentioning Sephardic Rishonim as well. So there is some. There's at least an awareness, if not a full-blown interaction with one another. But by the time we're in this period, it seems that there was some more freedom in terms of the cross-pollination of thought and ideas and tshuvas, responsa, etc., etc. But it's here that the Beis Yosef begins writing his commentary. And just to give a sense of what he was actually after, so a couple of snippets that I wanted to point out. What is the Beis Yosef responding to? Meaning, it's not simply the case that a big Talmud Chacham decides to write some sort of work, and it ends up being whatever it ends up being. And maybe that's the case when it comes to some sort of commentary on Shas, perhaps, right? As I'm learning Shas, so I'm going to develop my notes into some sort of readable text afterwards. But the Beis Yosef is a much more interesting sort of commentary. First of all, why does he decide to write it on the tour? Why does he write it as a commentary? Why doesn't he write it as its own standalone sefer? Is in of itself an interesting question. And what exactly is he responding to? What's the purpose? What's the goal of writing the sefer in the first place? So he spells it all out. First paragraph of this is the Hakdamah of the Beis Yosef. It says, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael Asher bara olam l'tachlis ha'adam, right? God bless, Hashem created the world for the sake of man. So he chose Am Yisrael, he chose Yaakov as his sort of pride and joy. By means of Moshe Rabbeinu, the pinnacle of all that the human race had to offer, he gave the rest of Klal Yisrael as a gift. Torah mitzvahs chukum mishpatim tzadikum latov lanu l'manelech b'derachav v'nimtzachin be'ein avol is a means of coming close to him so that we could find favor in the eyes of Hashem. V'hiki arkol lanu hayamim. So now he says, because we spent so many days, because we're so far from Har Sinai, because we spent so many days specifically in Galus, he says, huraknu mikli el kli, we've been poured out, such an interesting kind of expression, we've been dumped out, we've been poured out from one kli into another kli, from one vessel into another vessel. Uvagola halachnu, and we've been going in exile. The kamatzaros tzuros techufos v'tzaros, and we've had so many pains and difficulties, tzara after tzara, tzara immediately followed by another tzara, zula zu, one after the other. Bo aleinu have come upon us, ad kinis kayim banu ba'avonoseinu, v'avda chachmas chachamav. And we've lost the wisdom of our wise men. Vazalti ad ha-Torah, v'lomdea kilonasis ha-Torah kubeis toros, el katoros ein mispar. He says what we end up with now, today, it's not just like two toros. It's not just like there's this Torah and that Torah, which is always a concern, which is always the what we're engendered to avoid with Lotus Go to do, right? That we're not supposed to turn the Torah into two different Torahs. We have different flavors, but it's not supposed to be complete bifurcation all throughout the Jewish people. But he says that's where we are. It's where we are. Like, everybody's doing their own thing, and nobody really knows what to do, and there are so many different flavors that it's almost like we've lost all control. He says, why? Because there is an abundance now of svarim. There are so many svarim that are being produced. There is so much that's out there. There's so much available. Anybody decides, once upon a time, remember, that the notion of writing Torah Shebaal Peh was like, Yeharig Valyavor. You didn't do it. And then the floodgates don't exactly open. There's a trickle. There's the Mishnah, and then there's the Gemara, and then there's some very, very close comments, and then there's the era of the Rishonim. And he says, we're living in a world now where people just write, and they write, and they write, and they write, and they write. And everything is out there. So how are you supposed to know what to follow? How are you actually supposed to know what to do? The gam ki hey malei mashon kovanosom haisa lahayer mechashchenu. Even though the notion wasn't, the idea was that they should illuminate the darkness that we live in, meaning everybody's writing, presumably, with proper kavana. I'm trying to instruct my readership. I'm trying to instruct whoever's going to pick up my sefer and they're going to learn. It says the problem is you have so many of these svaras, so it's really twofold. First of all, and they're interrelated, but the reason why he writes the Beis Yosef is because, number one, we've been poured out from one kli to the next, from one vessel to the next, dumped from one country of the Gullus to another country. Think about his life. That he's living this story. We've gone from Spain to Portugal to the Ukraine, right, to Turkey, to Greece, back to Turkey, finally to Israel, and everybody, right, anybody could write his own story. So that's number one, and then number two is that the promulgation of all of these different perspectives about this should be the halacha or that should be the halacha, it becomes extremely confusing. And what's even more difficult, as he continues to write about, is that it's not so clear when anybody writes where they're necessarily coming from. Like, there isn't a great paper trail, which is something that the Beis Yosef brings about that is by no means obvious. Right? The idea that when he begins to quote the poskim that he does, he says, oh, and he says this and he says that, that it's not just these ideas floating around, but it's actually, and it's not out of fear of plagiarism, right? But just that you should know where I'm culling my actual information from, where it's coming from, makes a whole world of difference. He speaks about how there are contradictions. This rav in this city, he just writes something, and there's no fact checking, and you have no idea why, and you have no idea what the, you know, where he's coming from, and who he's quoting, and what the reason is, etc., etc. And there may be many, many others who contradict him, who are even greater than whoever he's quoting, but we don't know who he's quoting, we don't know who he's not quoting. He decides that he's going to sort of drill this down and make it a very, very usable sefer with the paper trail, with the harus, with the footnotes. Everything is going to be crystal clear. It's also going to be rather large, as well he'll get to when he comes to the Shulchan Aruch. That's number one. Number two, why on the tour? So this is a very interesting thing. Why on the tour? After all, the tour was Ashkenazi. Yosef Karo is a Sephardi. There already was a halakhic encyclopedia out there for the Sephardim that was written far, far before, far earlier than the Torah. So he says, first of all, if you go down to that second arrow there in the bottom paragraph, he says, the truth is, insofar as writing my own Sefer is concerned, v'lo ra'isi laso Sefer zeh chibur b'fnei atzmo. Didn't want to write it as its own book. Why not? Why is it better as a commentary? Frankly, you save ink. This way I don't have to write whatever. If I read it as a commentary on the tour, you have the words of the tour there. If I read it as a commentary on whatever sefer, that sefer is already there. I don't have to now repeat and recopy everything just for the sake of inclusion in my sefer. There's something that you gain by simply writing a commentary on a pre-existing sefer in terms of some of the groundwork already having been laid. The what?
And it also splits the religion into Ashkenazi Sephardi here. It's more like,
which is very also very interesting. So I read one suggestion. I don't know if this is it's not clear, at least from the Shulchan Aruch's own words, but that to a degree this is also sort of entry into the Ashkenazic world. That maybe in terms of getting something to be more widely read and widely accepted, if I'm the Sephardic Gaon and I write a commentary on that of the Ashkenazic one and the Ashkenazic rule book. So then maybe it'll get wider readership and more playing time, basically. It says, Lachain is kamti l'samcho le'echad meha poskim hamforsam. So I decided first that I'm going to attach my work to a previous work. It'll be a commentary. And then he says it's very, very interesting that this was actually the thought process of Rav Yosef Karo. Follow b'dayti l'samcho sefer Rambam. That's what I thought. I figured, why not write a commentary on the Rambam? By the way, Rav Yosef Karo does write commentary on the Rambam as well. He writes it after everything else. Just as a commentary on the Rambam, not to be Psak Halacha, but he writes a commentary on the Rambam, Kesef Mishnah, which is also very, very valuable as just this, as helping to provide some sort of a paper trail for what the Rambam was already dealing with. Sometimes you read a Rambam, you don't know where the Rambam, certainly don't know where the Rambam's coming from. The glory of the Rambam is that he pulls Svarim from all over Shas, gathers them into a more logical, encyclopedic sort of style, but they don't know where anything's coming from if you want to go back and learn it in the Gemara. Kesef Mishnah often lays that out. He says, so that was my original intention. Lioso hapose kayosim beforesam. After all, he's the biggest celebrity. Right? Everybody knows the Rambam. He's the most widely read, most widely distributed. He's held in the highest esteem. The Chazar TB. But then I decided otherwise. I reneged. Mibnei she'eno mevi elasvara achas. Here's the problem. And this really gets into why he wrote the Beis Yosef in the first place. When the Rambam writes a halacha, he says, this is the halacha. Beis Yosef says, I don't have time for that. That's not what I'm here to do. That's not the point. Meaning, it's almost as though the Rambam, much earlier, was the embodiment of the problem that Rav Yosef Karo sees in his own day. Right now, the difference between the Rambam and what Rav Yosef Karo saw in his own day was that the Rambam didn't live in his own day. So whereas people could sort of be very comfortable with the Rambam, it sounds like the principle of the thing is that you need to be able to see where things are actually coming from, which is what the tour really did. I need to write all the other, what all the other poskim think, and what all the other reasoning is out there. Lachin is kamti l'samcha l'sefer arba atrum, shechi b'harav rabbeinu Yaakov ben Arash, ki hu kolel rov deus ha-poskim. Because the tour was already incorporating many, many different poskim, and would quote them by name in his work. Therefore, a lot of the legwork has already been taken out, and he decides to go ultimately with the tour. Final point, just so that we can appreciate the breadth of what the Beis Yosef was actually doing. This is absolutely wild. Nimtza, final arrow. So the following is what we arrive at. Shemishiya sefer zel lefanav, one who has the sefer in front of him, yusidurim lefanav divrei ha-talmud in perish rashi, count this off. So he'll have all the words of the Gemara, divrei ha-talmud, in perish rashi, vatosos, vaharan, upiske ha-rif, vaharash, vamordechai, vaharam, vahagahosav. Right? So it's the Rambam and also the Haggah written by the Ravid. Umagid Mishnah, v'Rabbeinu Yerucham, v'Sefer HaTruma, v'Shibol HaLeket, v'Rokeach, v'Shari Dura, v'Sefer HaTashbetz, v'Sefer HaItur, v'Nimuka Yosef, v'Smag, v'Smag v'Rachos Chayim, v'Torah Sabayas, v'Gaos HaShri, v'Sefer HaManik, v'Agor, v'Sefer Bali HaNefesh, l'Harai, v'Tshuvas HaRash, v'Harash, but these are now the responses for him. HaRash, v'Harash, v'Avari Bar Sheshes, v'Arav Shem Ben Semach, v'Mari Kolon, v'Tshuvas HaDeshen. All in a day's work. All in a day's work. So he says that by reading the Beis Yosef, this is what you're getting. I've distilled all of this stuff down into my Beis Yosef. So if you read a Beis Yosef and you think like, oh, I don't like an yeshiva, you know, I just want to look at the, I don't want to start schlepping through a Beis Yosef. I just like, I want to see it in the Shulchan Aruch. So when we think about schlepping through all of these things, this is what he's going through. Mishnah Berurah does a very similar kind of thing in terms of discussing all the poskim from the time of the Beis Yosef until his day, which was just, you know, about 100 years ago, trying to work his way through all of that and distill it down into a very, very concise sort of fashion. So as broad, as heavy, as intense as the Beis Yosef is, consider, if you will, all that he's trying to encompass in his really, really very concentrated sort of work. It's an absolutely remarkable thing.
If these people are disagreeing with each other, like, how does he then?
Yeah. Like, so he says at the end, they didn't.
He clarifies it. He brings different opinions, and then he clarifies.
So what he says, and I don't have. It's argued that as much as the Beis Yosef says he's doing this, he doesn't necessarily. But what he says he does is, aside from going with the Ikar Rishonim, he looks at the Gimel Hamudin, the Shlosh Hamudin HaAlacha, right? The three primary Rishonim are the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. Two out of three wins, right? That's in terms of Psak Halacha, right? Two out of three wins. So there's the Rambam, the Rush, and the Rif, or the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. Two out of three wins when there is debate and when there is disagreement. I can't tell you this with certainty, but it's argued that that's not a hard and fast rule. And the Beis Yosef's own Svara, once having learned through all of these other Rishonim and bringing all these other Rishonim, then ultimately may carry the day. Maybe yes in some circumstances and no in other circumstances. But those are the three primary sources. So you can understand, two out of three, by the way, are Svardi. And the third, the Rush, moves to Spain. Right, so you can imagine that perhaps this doesn't sit so well with the Ashkenazic authorities. Indeed, it's on the heels of the publishing of the Beis Yosef that Rav Moshe Isserles, who holds Rav Yosef Karo in extremely high esteem, nevertheless writes his own commentary on the Torah, sort of to resist the overwhelming influence that the Beis Yosef would otherwise have, and he authors the Darkei Moshe for the Ashkenazim to have a sense that there may be another side to the story. He also, the Beis Yosef, does not incline especially favorably or heavily towards Tosos, right, which are really the heavy hitters of the Ashkenazic world during the early Middle Ages and the generations following Rashi. So a lot of back and forth between the world of the Sfarim and the world of the Ashkenazim, but it's absolutely remarkable what the Beis Yosef puts together. And the question before about how is there even any overlap and how is there back and forth and how much communication could there have been only casts in that much more impressive a light the job that he had. It's not like you just walk into any base medrash or like you log on to Bar Ilan and like you have all this stuff at your fingertips. I mean, this is a remarkable. And with, you know, today, like in yeshiva, you look askance at anything that you download from, you know, Hebrew books. Because, the printing, you know. Like, I have to waste my time, you know, telling the difference between, is that like an Aleph or a Ches, because there's an ink blot on it. Who needs it? You know, the The Machon Yerushalayim, you know, pays 20 younger light and some kol in Bnei Brak, and they go through it all, and then by the time I can pull it off the shelf in the Beis Medrash, everything is crystal clear and spick and span and absolutely beautiful. I mean, what it meant to learn through these things, manuscripts very often, was, I mean, just a remarkable, remarkable achievement. And what needs to also be noted is look at where the Beis Yosef was. This is not, one would think, the sort of lifestyle that's conducive to beginning to put something like this together. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, he's kicked out of his home. He bounces around. Who knows? This is like the kind of childhood that we would think somebody would need like many, many, many years of therapy to be able to get over. He's displaced not once, but twice. He should be laying on a couch someplace, you know, unloading all of his worries. And not like sitting down to write a base. It's absolutely remarkable. To the Ukraine, to Turkey, and Greece, finally settles in Eretz Yisrael. By the time he settles in Eretz Yisrael, really this is well on its way, and he's already held in very high esteem. By the time he even gets there, he very quickly becomes a member of the intellectual and Kabbalistic elite of Tzfat, just about as soon as he gets there.
He's so schlepping all those manuscripts from coast to
coast. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
no. I mean, it's a tremendous amount.
It's like not to be believed, not to be believed, right? And he's still making time for a chavrusa shaft of the Malach. I mean, it's really, you know, it's a really, really, it's just an amazing thing. Absolutely incredible.
How old was he when he died?
87.
Is that the man? Yeah. Is that?
He gets a very long life also for that time period.
It happened.
Yeah,
it's pretty wild. Yeah. Tzfat. On to Tzfat. So it's interesting, we would think that, you know, like if you're going to Israel, first you stop at the Haas Promenade, and you overlook, and everybody takes pictures, and like you spend some time in Yerushalayim. Tzfat was very, very much the epicenter of Jewish life and Jewish activity. These are a couple of mud. If you've never spent any time, just to have a little bit of a sense of what it was like. The way that it looks today is very much, at least to a degree, the way that it looked like actually in the time of Rav Yosef Karo and his Rebbeim and contemporaries and Talmidim. Narrow cobblestone snaking alleyways and the like, and also these incredible, incredible vistas. Tzfat is all the way up in the north of Israel, and you're in this incredible mountain range. You're right across the valley from Meron, which is the burial place of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. So it stands to reason that because of the geography and the topography and the actual placement vis-a-vis other important locations in Kabbalistic thought, this becomes really an epicenter of Kabbalah. In addition to Halacha, it needs to be noted as well. Sometimes we just think of Tzfat as being like, oh, you know, people kind of dancing through the streets and like these long flowing, tunics, and everybody's like high as a kite on something or other. But this is also the epicenter of Halacha. Is again, I think the fact that the Beis Yosef's presence there very much shows it to be so. When Rav Yosef Karo gets to Tzfat, He comes under the influence, tutelage, friendship of Rav Yaakov Beirav. This is the plaque outside of the cave containing Rav Yaakov Beirav, as well as others. It's hard to see, but Moreno Rav Yaakov Beirav, Rav Yaakov Beirav, it's sort of an interesting placement. Mechadesh hasmicha b'tzvat. He reinstated smicha. And Tzfat, have you heard about this?
Yeah, but it never took off.
It never took off. It lasts for all of four generations. There was an attempt by Rav Yaakov Beirav, also born in Spain, he had the opposite trajectory. It's interesting how when we think about people fleeing Spain, we usually think about maybe South America a little bit, but really North Africa, right? And that's how like Middle Eastern Jews become, the Sephardic Jews end up in the Middle East, North Africa and the Middle East. We think of that kind of southern loop. That's the direction that Rav Yaakov Beirav takes. Somehow or another, Rav Yosef Karo ends up in the Ukraine, at least for a period of time, before coming down to Turkey and Greece. But meanwhile, he comes to Tzfat having had a very similar path in life, and again, with all of the Chevle Mashiach implications, and perhaps this sense of of the importance of the renewal of Eretz Yisrael into the new messianic kind of kingdom, perhaps. But Rav Yaakov Beirav gets this idea that he's going to reinstate Smicha. Smicha is not this. This is not really Smicha. This is a certificate from somebody. I don't know, this is not mine. This is a certificate that is a very typical standard certificate that you get from yeshiva when you study for what we call rabbinical ordination. Smicha literally means lesmoch, right? To lean upon, literally, is the leaning of hands by the Rebbe unto and upon the Talmud. So this is what happens with Moshe Rabbeinu and Yehoshua. This is how Yehoshua then gives smicha to the Zikanim after him, etc., etc., so on and so forth, until the dissolution of the whole system. This is one of the problems of Galus. But now with sort of this kibbutz galus and people converging back upon Sfat and back in Eretz Yisrael, there's the idea of maybe we can kind of reinstate this. The Rambam speaks about the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael all deciding to bestow smicha upon a person, and that actually would be how we would reinstate smicha. So Rabbi Yaakov Beirav gets this idea that, like, let's do it. Everybody convenes, or a whole group of Talmidei Chachamim, leading, recognized Gedolei Sfat, Gedolei Eretz Yisrael, they convene, they meet, they bestow smicha upon Rabbi Yaakov Beirav and others. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav gives smicha to, among others, to Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo, Mechaber, HaShulchan Aruch, the Acherim, Nolad, etc. This is when he was born. Fine. So he reinstates smicha, gives smicha to Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo is very, very taken with this idea. And again, you have to wonder if part of this is like something of a messianic sort of spirit. Not overtly so, not proclaiming that I'm Mashiach and you're Mashiach and he's Mashiach and Yechi Adonenu, but just that maybe, like, you know, like it's coming, you know, we're back in Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, it's like Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, this is like very exciting, here we are living in Tzat. So it's interesting. It's interesting to think that maybe that's in part what was behind it. There are also certain halachic complications that can only really be cleared up if you have an actual real sitting based in with real dayanim who have smicha. Rav Yosef Karo turns around and gives smicha to his student, Rav Moshe Alshich, who's actually next, who's actually buried right next to Mahari Beirav. We refer to him as Ha'alshich HaKadosh. Right? He wrote a very, very important commentary on Tanakh, and he is the student of Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rav Moshe Alshich in turn then gives smicha, this is the final smicha, to Rav Chaim Vital, who's also a very heavy hitter in the Tzfat landscape. Rav Chaim Vital can be said to be the student of Rav Moshe Alshich, of Rav Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, who's also a student of Rav Yosef Karo. Moshe Cordovero wrote, anybody know?
L'Chadori.
That was Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, L'Chadori. Rav Moshe Cordovero wrote Tomer Devora, right? Really the leading Kabbalist of his, like, half-generation, student of Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Moshe Cordovero also taught Rav Chaim Vital. Rav Chaim Vital also becomes the primary disciple of the Ari HaKadosh, who somehow or another kind of, like, rewrites the book on Kabbalah. There's some difference between the Kabbalah of Rav Moshe Cordovero and the Kabbalah of the Ari, of Rav Yitzchak Luria. What it is, I don't know. I can't tell you. My Magid told me that I couldn't tell you. So I don't know what exactly the difference is. But there's a lot going on in Tzfat in the world of Kabbalah here. And again, in terms of this whole notion of smicha, it's very interesting. It lasts four generations, the second of which is Rav Yosef Karo, who is taken enough with this. This isn't just like bowing your head to your Rebbe. In turn, he tries to get it up off the ground, turns around, and does the same to his student as well. Rav Yosef Karo Shul. Just note the blue. The blue is a very, very big thing in Tzfat. There is something Kabbalistic about blue, something about Ayin Hara and keeping Ayin Hara away. You can actually visit this today. This is Rav Yosef Karo Shul. If you've been in Tzfat, it's right off. You turn immediately off of the main art gallery drag in Tzfat, where all the little art galleries are off that main shuk. And Rav Yosef Karo Shul allegedly, just about the way that he left it, the Ari's shul is on sort of the other side of town, which would come about a generation later. But this was Rav Yosef Karo Shul. Rav Yosef Karo, certainly following the following the death of Rav Yaakov Beirav, was really seen as the head honcho, sort of that he was the Av Beis Din of Tzfat following the death of Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. So it's here that he writes the Shulchan Aruch. We usually, it's interesting, we don't call Rav Yosef Karo, it's like the Chafetz Chaim, right? Nobody called it. He wasn't running around this little boy being called, you know, the Chafetz Chaim, the Chafetzi or whatever. He had a name, right? We call Rabbanim by the name of the work that they write. We refer to him as the Beis Yosef. We don't refer to him as the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Yosef is the far, far more impressive of the two works. Indeed, the Beis Yosef was what makes the Shulchan Aruch possible. If not for the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch could really fall under the rubric of all of the problems that Rav Yosef Karo himself was writing about when he wrote his introduction to the Beis Yosef. The problem of having a sefer, you don't know where anything comes from, you don't know who says, why should that be the case. It's the Beis Yosef that legitimizes the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Yosef is an extremely impressive work, and then on the heels of the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo condenses it down into the Shulchan Aruch. To have a sense, another quick snippet, and save this for the back as well, but in the introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, again, tells you what he's actually doing. He tells you what the point is, what the purpose is. At this point, Rav Yosef Karo is held in extremely high esteem. The Shulchan Aruch is completed or published at least 1565. And obviously a very, very impressive work, but doesn't cover nearly the breadth of scope that that he does in the Beis Yosef. Let me take you to just read through this quickly. He says, "Ode Hashem Obefi Uvasach Rabba Mahalanu Mishirai Ahudenu." It's this top paragraph here. So he's giving praise to Hashem for having been able to accomplish this. Hashem has blessed me, and He's provided me with all of His shefa, all of His influence, that I've been able to do this. Kadosh Baruch Hu does so. Shval Anoshim upon the lowliest of men, Kamoni, like myself. Lechaber Sefer Anosin and Reshefer Chibra Gadol Shechibarti Al Ba Atur Meshir Karasi Beis Yosef. Hashem has already given me the ability to write my already well known commentary of the Beis Yosef. Also the footnotes, right? Not only the poskim themselves, but to be able to say where I've actually gleaned it all from. The new responsa, the old responsa, the midrashi halacha, both talmudim, etc., etc. Nisbar Hashem called in Vadin Be'er Hetev. Davar Davar Al Ofnav. The Armon Al Mishpato. It's a beautiful expression. The palace founded upon its foundation. Yashav Talui Alav Kol Shilte Agiborim Anche Hashem Asher Me'olam. So he describes what he did in the Beis Yosef to compile all these different sources, to distill them down into a workable actual parish. And he gave you the full explanation as to what exactly he did in that particular work. Raisi Ani Belibi. But now I've seen in my heart. Says, now I've decided that the truth is we have another problem. This issue of being shagura b'fiv, right? The notion of being able to have the halacha actually at your fingertips and on your tongue. It's great to have the Beis Yosef. I've given it all to you. I've told you where it comes from. I've told you where the halacha emanates from. I've given you the machlokas. I've told you that it's from this parak of the Gemara and that parak of the Gemara, and this is who comments on it, and this is what they say. But now you end up with a problem of not really being able to spit that back out. It's not a great... There's no great ability to have a conversation with somebody and just have the whole Beis Yosef just at the tip of your tongue and at your fingertips. So he says that now this notion of things being shagur b'fi kol ish Yisrael, ki kasher yish'alu l'talmid chacham davar halacha, I want the world to look like the following, that if you ask a talmid chacham what the halacha is, will you gam gain ba? He won't be confused, he won't err, eli yomar, rather he'll just be able to say, sorry, it's a little dark in here. L'chachma achosi. L'chachma achosiat. You can say to chachma achosiat. Say that there's a drush of Chazal. That you can say to chachma that you are my sister. Meaning, k'shem shebarilo sh'achoso asuralo. The other day, darshan is that the level of chachma that a person should achieve, that the same way that a person could respond about it, says, sure, sister, absolutely, it's one of the arayos, everybody knows that. Kach yiyeh barur lo kol din sheyishal alav, halacha lamaisa. So everything should be able to be as clear, everything should be able to be as concise, and you can give the halacha lamaisa easily. P'yoser shagur b'fiv should be fluent in his mouth. So he says, Sefer zeh habanu l'talpios tel sh'akol ponim bo l'chalko chalakim shloshim l'lmod bo b'chol yom chelek. He says that the idea is to be able to divide this into 30 different pieces, and you learn a little bit of this Shulchan Aruch of mine every day. And what emerges then, if you're learning a little bit of Shulchan Aruch every day, just a little bit, 1/30 of the Shulchan Aruch every day, what do you end up with? V'nimtza sh'b'chol chodesh hu chozer tamudo. Every 30 days. It's great. Every 30 days you go through Shulchan Aruch. It's a brilliant idea. So the reality is, on the one hand, it's laughable. Right? I mean, the joke's on us. That's the reality. On the one hand, it's go through the entire Shulchan Aruch every 30 days. It should be noted that, of course, that when we look at the Shulchan Aruch and we think of the Shulchan Aruch, we think of the Shulchan Aruch with the Shach and the Taz, or we think of the Shulchan Aruch with the Mug and Avraham, we think of the Shulchan Aruch with the Agra underneath. Right? It's huge. It's huge because of all the Perushim. Those Perushim become very, very important. It's what provides the stick. It's what provides the staying power to the Shulchan Aruch. That all the other Mefarshim decided to write their commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch lends it a great deal of credence. But nevertheless, appreciate this is what he was writing it for. So he's writing it not... The Beis Yosef is there so that you'll know that this halacha comes from this Gemara, that the Ran argues with the Rambam about it, that the Rush has an interesting thing to say, and now this is like the final word. That's what the Beis Yosef is there for. You want to know what actually to do. You want to know how to keep the halacha. So here's the Shulchan Aruch. You roll through it like once a month. Once a month. By the way, he's not suggesting that one supplant the other. He means you'll go through this once a month in addition to whatever else you're learning. Right? You keep learning the Beis Yosef, and you'll... This way you know which Gemara to pull off the shelf, and you'll learn that Gemara, so you'll know the halacha, and you'll know, like, the Iyun of the halacha, and the backdrop, the background, etc., etc. And then, whatever, you know, like, you know, Ben Gavra LeGavra, you know, during laning, you'll go through the Shulchan Aruch once every 30 days, and you'll be done. Piece of cake. He says one other interesting thing. If you just jump down a line, he says, Zos ve'od ha-talmidim ha-ketanim yegubo tamid. He says, by the way, Talmidim Ketanim, everything that he said until now, he said, remember, I see a world, I have a dream. I see a world where you ask a Talmid Chacham what the halacha is, and he tells you, this is what the halacha is. Right? Just so that I can know what to do. Forgetting all the lundas, and forgetting all the background, forgetting the machlokas rishonim. This is what I'm supposed to do. That's why I wrote the Shulchan Aruch, so that Rabbanim can be able to spit out the halacha with such great ease. And then, by the way, there's also Va'oda Talmidim Akatanim Yagubo Tamid. They should also be studying this constantly. If you're not, you know, you don't have such breadth and don't have, you know, such ability in terms of learning, at least you'll be able to learn Shulchan Aruch, and very, very quickly you'll be able to basically go through a condensed version of Kol HaTorah Kula. So he sort of has these two different ideas in mind. It's supposed to serve as Talmidei Chacham as far as being a quick review. It's also supposed to serve as the Hamon Am, the masses who can't necessarily learn on that level, also to be able to basically become their primary source for all learning. Something one last point, at least on the Shulchan Aruch, is that the Ramah sort of does for the Shulchan Aruch what Rav Yosef Karo does for the tour, right? You can argue all you want. Right? You can argue all you want with something. But you don't argue with a 2-year-old. Right? The fact that you are... maybe we can talk about this now because it's actually over. Right? If Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are standing on the same stage, as much as one of them may have refused to insist that the other was even a viable candidate, but the fact that you're sharing a stage means something. Right? I'm not up here arguing with a 2-year-old. I'm not up here arguing with a 5-year-old. I'm not up here arguing with, you know, someone. I'm just going to pull somebody up onto the stage from the audience and argue with him and debate with him. The fact that you engage in debate means that you recognize and respect the authority and the scholarship of whoever it is that you're arguing with. Otherwise, you don't bother. You give a little pat on the shoulder, on the head, and, you know, have a good day. The Ramah did not really have to write the Mapa L'Shulchan. Right? Ultimately, that's what the Ramah does. The Ramah has the Shulchan Aruch sitting in his hands. The popularity of the Beis Yosef, of Rav Yosef Karo, is already huge. And the Ramah sees that it's just not enough for the Ashkenazic world, because it doesn't contain all of the leanings of some of the other Ashkenazic authorities, B'lai Tosfos, etc., etc. But what the Ramah does is that rather than write his own work, he writes a work that associates with and that interacts with the Shulchan Aruch. It's just glosses to the Shulchan Aruch. It really brings the Shulchan Aruch up to speed for the Ashkenazic masses. That's one important addition, that it becomes sort of Ashkenazified. The other thing that the Ramah does is that the Ramah inclines towards Minhagim in a way that the Shulchan Aruch really doesn't. The Shulchan Aruch, has his whole analysis, and he says that, you know, these are the Rishonim, Pesach, etc., etc. But what the Ramah really does is often says, and by the way, this is, you know, Kach Anu Nohagim, or that this is how we act in Ashkenaz, and that's really like the final word. If this is how we do it, then that must be what's appropriate. There's a lot of academia about this, the notion of the distinction between the Sephardic world and the Ashkenazic world. It's called the presumption of holiness that exists in the Ashkenazic world that doesn't necessarily exist in the Sephardic world. Much of that may be due to the fact that if you are totally embattled by Galus in a way that the Ashkenazic world wasn't quite, the ability to hold on to Minhagim may have been done with greater ease and more insulation than was necessarily done in the Sephardic world. At any rate, the fact that the Ramah doesn't write his own work really is what ultimately gives the seal of approval and gives tremendous, tremendous staying power to the Mechaber. The Ramah is not the only one in the fold. And indeed, shortly thereafter, the Yamshel Shlomo, from Shlomo Luria, who's the Ashkenazic authority, nothing to do with the Ari, I don't think anything to do with the Ari, sort of makes an attempt at an Ashkenazi stand-alone work of halacha. Rav Mordechai Yaffa writes the Lavush, again, as an attempt to sort of make an Ashkenazi almost Shulchan Aruch. It's really more of an Ashkenazi Beis Yosef than an Ashkenazi Shulchan Aruch. But there were these attempts. What the Ramah does, though, for the Shulchan Aruch is basically casts it as the go-to source for halacha, really until today. Following the Ramah, there are other authorities who do it as well. The fact that the Taz comments, Rav David, Levi Segel, the Shach, we're going to talk about in another lecture, does the same. Shabbosai HaKohen, when other authorities, even when they argue, and even when they say that I think he got it wrong, nevertheless, take the time to actually comment on the work of another, just tremendous, tremendous respect for the authority of that author. And that's basically where the Shulchan Aruch is today. The Shulchan Aruch, because of the Ramah, especially in Ashkenazic circles, but even before then in Sephardic circles, has certainly become the premier halachic authority in print form for anyone and everyone. It's just an absolutely remarkable work when you consider the life of the Beis Yosef, what he actually did, where he traveled through, how difficult a journey he actually had, and the notion that he could nevertheless produce something that all of Klal Yisrael is indebted to is an absolutely remarkable feat. Those are the life and times. It can't be Hanukkah and have a biography about the Beis Yosef without actually seeing the Beis Yosef on Hanukkah. If you just flip the page over, this is not, and I was reluctant to do this, because this is not a great sampling of the Beis Yosef. Getting a great sense of the Beis Yosef would have been to see where he quotes a bunch of different Rishonim, and then he has his final word, and he has an analysis. But at the very least, I think you certainly have the idea that this is not just a halacha psuka sort of sefer. It's not just, here's the halacha, this is what you do, period, end of story. This musing and this question that the Beis Yosef brings up here in Hilchos Chanukah is a question that certainly you've heard before, we've all heard before, maybe we've even seen it inside, maybe yes, maybe no. But it's worth taking a look at. In the The Beis Yosef, by the way, this is what it looks like, at least in common form. You have the tour in the middle, the Beis Yosef flanks on one side, the Beis Chodesh, the Bach from Yoel Circus flanks on the other side. So if you look at the right-hand side of the paper, smack in the middle here, the Ikka.
When did the Bach write his?
Later, sort of as a response. As much as the Bach was something of a response to the Beis Yosef, said the Beis Yosef wouldn't be the be-all and end-all, his son-in-law, the Bach's son-in-law, was the Taz. And the Taz writes his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And by writing his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, that basically seals the fate of the Shulchan Aruch being the go-to even for the Ashkenazi world. The Taz does it, then the Shach does it, and but the Bach does this as something of a response to the Beis Yosef.
Have more Ashkenazi.
Yeah, there's a sense that, like, I don't know if it's just Ashkenazi pride or if it's a sense that, I mean, the Rama is extremely respectful even when he argues. The Rama in his Hakdama, you could take a look at it if you like, the Rama in his Hakdama basically says, like, what else do I have to add? Like, the Shulchan Aruch, Ahri Yosef Karol, the Gadol Hador, what else do I have to add? So, but it still needs to be noted that Ashkenazim don't always follow whatever the Shulchan Aruch wrote, so I'm going to, tell you where we do otherwise. But it's amazing. I mean, for somebody of the Rama's stature to bow his head says a great deal about who the Beis Yosef was. It says a great deal about who the Rama was, that he was, and he didn't need to sort of steal the limelight and come up with his own sefer. Just a couple of notes here and there when Ashkenazic practice differed is a remarkable thing. But the Beis Yosef writes as follows, question that we've certainly heard before. Ve'ikal amedak. So he asks as follows. He says, you could really analyze this. Lama kavu shmona yamim. Why did we establish Chanukah for 8 days? Where do we get this idea of Chanukah for 8 days? Why? He says, after all, the kevan de shemesh v'pach hayabo, since there was really enough oil in the pach, in the flask, to last for one night, so the nes is only for 7 nights. This is the kasha of the Beis Yosef, or the shiloh maybe of the Beis Yosef. Why is it that Chazal established Chanukah for being 8 days if the miracle only lasted 7 days? Have a 7-day holiday, right? The answer that it would like throw the Chanukiah out of equilibrium. Say, you come up with a different design. So he gives, famously, again, 3 different answers. Again, this isn't, like, really, really vintage, especially because he doesn't say where any of these answers are coming from. Ordinarily, you would find, if you even just look around in the next couple of paragraphs, right, you have, like, a quote from a Gemara later on, totally not Rambam, that's for sure. Previously, he quotes a Rashi, and he quotes the Ran, and has a whole conversation about incorporating their commentaries also. Again, this was, it seems obvious to us, but this was a very unusual sefer for the time. So he says, first answer, V'yesh lamar, shechilku shemen shebepach l'shmona chalakim, you divide, what they did was they actually divided the oil into 8 different parts. V'chol laila, and each and every night, hayu nosnim b'menorah chelak echad, they would put 1/8 of the oil in for every night, which means that if 1/8 of a flask of oil that in of itself should only last one night, an 1/8 of that oil should only last 1/8 of the night. But nevertheless, when they actually lit it, vayadolek ad haboker, it burned, it illuminated, it lasted all the way until the morning.
25 days, you had 25 days of
why? Oh, why 8 days? Because it took them 8 days to actually bring the oil.
Right.
They knew that the process would take 8 days. V'nimtza shebechol halelos nasa nes. So what happens is Israel. I don't know.
Every day they would be able to go a Surah process, correct? Which is the Persian mile. That's what the Gemara says.
Right.
That's 40 process. Where's 40 process?
No, but it says that the actual process, because since they took only one drop out of the olive and all that took time.
But also to go and to come back. Well, that should be
4 days or 4 days.
I think that's the Beis Yosef quotes the.
In the beginning, he says.
Take a look. If you go back, that Ran, if you go 4 lines up. The previous paragraph. Atam shotzuchu lahadlik shmona yamim. Why was it 8 days? Meosa pach mepnei shekol Yisrael hayu becheskas tamei mesim. V'yevshar lahaskin shemen tahor atchiyav roleim shiva yamim miyom tumasam viyom echad l'ksishas azesim. It's one answer, is that it was the Tara process. That first they had to undergo the process of Tara for 7 days, and then they could, even if it was available immediately, even if there was an olive tree or an olive grove right next to Yerushalayim, so they would still require 7 days before they could even interact with the oil and press the oil. The Ran, I think, is the more famous of the end. This is what we were just discussing. The Ran Kasav, Shahayu Lahem Shemen Tar Rachok Arba Yamim, that the oil was available at only a 4 days journey away. Futsu Khushmara Yamim Bein Alichav Chazara. Where exactly that puts them, I don't know. What city, I'm not sure. as compared to Yerushalayim, I don't know. But a 4 days journey from Yerushalayim would be where they could actually get the oil. You know, if the oil didn't take really much time to actually process or manufacture, then they could bring it back with the next 4 days. It's answer one. Answer two. Some ask on this, by the way, what would give you the right to divide the oil into 8 days? Says who? How can you do that? Right? In some chadal hanes. Right? So meaning if I have a flask of oil that'll last one night, light it now. I don't know what tomorrow will bring. Who knows what's going to happen? Right? But why would I do an eighth of a mitzvah? If I have an opportunity to do a mitzvah now, do the mitzvah now.
You're going
to
miss the lighting? No matter how long. If it lasts...
So then, bechlal. So why do you? So but meaning, if the actual, but if the actual mitzvah is in the actual is in the hadlaka, so then maybe I don't care as much about. But that's like the famous kasha, at least on this first teretz of the Beis Yosef, that what would necessarily give you the right to do so? I'm stranded on a desert island, and there are a bunch of like wild boars running around. And I have one cow. A burger's bar, like parachutes down. I have one kosher hamburger. So, like, do I, divide it into 27 different parts? And, like, I'll have a little chelik of it. And then for my other meals, I'll have, I'll have a wild boar. I eat all the kosher food now when I run out of kosher food. So then, anasrachona patre, and I go on and I do whatever I need to do. But anyway, that's answer number one. Answer number two, all famous answers. Vodiyash lomar. Shala'acha shenitnu shemen b'neiros ha-menorah kashir, nishar hapach malei kibitchila. Even after they poured all the, they poured all the oil in, look back on the pach, it's still full. It's like the Baba Sali's arak. You know the Baba Sali's arak, right? Like you wrap the towel around the arak and you keep pouring and pouring. And it's still full. It's amazing. Keeps on pouring, but it's full. V'nikar ha'nesaf b'layla harishan, which means that even on the first night there was already a nes, right? Granted, there was already enough oil to last for the first night, but the idea that on the first night I'm still looking at a pach full of oil, so then that's a nes. Inami or else as follows. Shebalel rishon, nitnu kol hashemen b'neros, that on the first night they put all of the shemen in, v'dalku kol halayla, and they lit, and they burned. There's nothing left in the pach. You look in the pach, bone dry. Pour all the oil in, there's nothing left. But you light it. And you come back in the morning, and you find, u'baboker matzu haner was maleim shemen. They didn't burn up at all. Right? Meaning the fuel hadn't actually been used up. It's still going and going and going, and there's no sense that it even diminished. And if that be the case, then v'chem kol laylo laylo, if that happened each and every night, then it's a nace that is recognizable each and every night. Hence, in Nights of Chanukah, I think there's a sefer that has like 1,001 different answers to the Beis Yosef's kasha. But this is the kasha of the Beis Yosef. One other just item that I neglected to make note of when we were reading through this whole list of all the sources that the Beis Yosef includes. So critical and so formative is the Beis Yosef on the shaping of learning and Jewish scholarship, that the divide in halacha between Rishonim and Achronim is the Beis Yosef. If you're quoted by the Beis Yosef, you're a Rishon, and if you're not quoted by the Beis Yosef, you're an Acharon. Right? There's a whole new layer of authority and a whole new measure of authority that's given to those that the Beis Yosef looked up to as being quotable, and those who the Beis Yosef didn't quote, right? Because they weren't around yet, either his contemporaries or they came about subsequently. So really, an absolute. I mean, it cannot be overstated just how monumental the Beis Yosef was as a work, how monumental the Shulchan Aruch was as a work. The very end of his life, again, the last work that he ever published was the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, and then posthumously some other works and writings and the like have come out from Rav Yosef Karo. But Freilich and Chanukah, thank you for spending the time celebrating our celebrity, the person we really put up on a pedestal.
So.
So who wrote the Kitzel Shulchan Aruch, and do we have to finish that every single day? Because it's an abridged version.
Gansfried.
Rosh Shlomo Gansfried wrote it.
That's Ashkenazi.
It is Ashkenazi.
It's really Ashkenazi. That's Hungarian. I don't know what category that
we're, is. We're, ouch.